It was almost in my backyard. Not quite. It was 20 miles away. Well, we've been back from the feast for a little while now. We actually got back, you know, as close as I lived. I didn't get home until Friday night at 6:30. Of course, I was in no hurry to get home. I wanted to stretch it out as long as I could. And so we stayed overnight on Thursday night. We were actually going to go out on a boat ride on Friday, but the boat ride was canceled because the weather was, well, it was pretty windy that day, and there were high seas, and they canceled the trip, so we didn't go out on the boat on Friday. But we did get all the kids back together. The kids had gone home, our kids and grandkids had gone home the night before, and we got back up with them and all went out to dinner Friday evening before going home. So then we made it home at about 6:30 Friday night. So we've been back for just a little over a week now. Hope you all had a wonderful feast. I hope you had a safe trip back. Obviously, you're here, so you must have made out okay. Hopefully, there were no serious issues that went on with you on your trip home, and it was an uneventful trip and a very comfortable one. And hopefully, at the feast, you accomplished three things. You appeared before God as He commanded, which I think we all did that. You rejoiced before God and had a wonderful time. And finally, you learned something. You learned something about God's kingdom and about yourself. Perhaps you're already looking forward to the next feast. How many of you are looking forward to the next feast already? I know I am. Absolutely. It's never too early to begin thinking about it and preparing for it, even though it's still more than a year away, because it doesn't occur until mid-October next year. But it's never too early to start thinking about it and preparing. But while we start thinking about the next feast, let's ask ourselves a question. Are there still lessons to learn from this year's feast? Is there still something that we could learn from the feast that we've just experienced? Is the learning over now that we're home? Or is there something else? Many years ago, I was a college student up in Towson, and I was a natural science major. And when I was in college, I took a lot of scientific courses as a science major. I took classes in physics, and in biology, and in chemistry, and astronomy, and what other scientific classes did I take? I took one course that was totally devoted to light and color, which is good because I'm colorblind, and that's don't know how well I did in that class, but it was very educational, very informative. A lot of these classes that I took, you know, were part of the curriculum that I needed these classes for my major. And each one of the science courses, the physics and chemistry and biology and natural sciences, all involved 6 hours a week in class. Most of them were 4-credit classes, and they involved 6 hours. 3 hours were 1-hour lectures, and they usually occurred on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And then there was a 3-hour lab class. And in the lab class, which would occur on a Tuesday or a Thursday, that class would go for 3 hours, and we would have a hands-on experience of what we were being taught in class. Take, for example, in chemistry class, we would go into the lectures 3 days a week, and we would hear a lecture on chemistry. We would hear about different molecules and atoms and compounds and different things like that, things that are taught in chemistry. And that would all maybe make sense to us a little bit, maybe not. Maybe some of it would go over our heads, and we didn't understand what the professor was talking about. But when we went into the lab, we were able to put to practice some of the things that we were being taught. The concepts that were being given to us during the lectures, we were able to use them in the lab. We were able to use what we learned in the lectures. There are some things about chemistry, for example, that you can't just get out of a lecture. You have to try things out for yourself and see what it's all about. And so we had the labs to help us to have that hands-on experience and learn what chemistry was all about. In some ways, the feast is a lot like that. It's a lot like the lab class. Today I want to discuss the lessons that we learn at the feast. I want to discuss the things that we're taught, the things that we learn, and how some of them don't hit us until we get back home. Some of the things that we learn at the feast don't sink in until we get back home. What did you learn at the feast? Well, we go to the feast and we hear sermons generally relating to the kingdom of God. That's what the feast is all about. We're there to celebrate the coming kingdom of God. And the messages are primarily geared toward that topic about God's coming kingdom. Because after all, we are to be preaching meat in due season, aren't we? This is the time to concentrate on the kingdom that we look forward to. It's the time to focus our minds on what lies ahead after Christ returns. In fact, our entire commission, the commission of the church, is to preach the gospel of the kingdom. That's what it's all about. At the feast, you know, we focus on more of the details of that kingdom. Because that's what we're here for. That's our commission, to preach the gospel of the kingdom. So at the feast, we focus more on it to give us a better understanding of it. And so we're kind of getting a graduate level instruction there, a higher level of instruction about God's kingdom. There's another reason that God brings us together at this time. It's another reason that God puts us all in one place at His feast. See, the feast is also a workshop. The feast is a workshop for us to practice being in God's kingdom. It's a time that we have to put to practice what we've been learning about what God's kingdom will be like and how wonderful it will be and how the whole world is going to be at peace. We have the opportunity at the feast to practice that a little bit. See, when we're away from the feast, when we're not at the feast the rest of the year, we're surrounded by non-church members. We're surrounded by people who don't have the slightest idea of why they're here, what the purpose of man's existence is, let alone what God's plan is. So we're surrounded by non-members. It's not the way it's going to be in God's kingdom. In God's kingdom, we're going to be surrounded by people who are all learning God's way. So it's going to be a different world. But it's not like that today. We're in the world, even though we're not of the world. But when we go to the feast, we're among God's people, everywhere, all around us. And that's especially true at some of the larger sites in lesser populated areas. Especially true in places like Wisconsin Dells, where you have a lot of people, but you don't have a big population in the area. And so most of the people you see during the feast are going to be church members. It was especially true at Jekyll Island back in the mid-70s. I remember going there back then and we had services in this huge tent. And the tent held 8,000 people. And Jekyll Island only held about 8,100 people. I mean, we pretty much filled it to capacity. It was all church people on the island. There was no one else there. If you walk down the street, if you went into a store, chances are everybody you bumped into was a church member. It was like nobody else was on the island. It was like it's just us. And that's a wonderful feeling. If you've never experienced that, it's really, really great. You really felt like you were in God's kingdom. Because it was just that way with everyone in the church all around you. It's also true at some of the smaller sites and some of the international sites where you don't have that many people there. You have maybe less than 100. Or the entire group does everything together. They all eat all their meals together. They go on tours of different places together. Everything they do is together. And even there, you get that same feeling of it's just us. It's just the church. It's just God's people here. All of that gives us the opportunity to practice being in God's kingdom. Gives us the chance to have that lab exercise where we are practicing what it's like. Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 34. Jeremiah 31, verse 34. It says, "No more shall every man teach his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, says the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and their sin I will remember no more." In God's kingdom, everyone is going to be a part of God's church. Everyone is going to be taught God's way. It's going to be a different world. What a great time that will be when everyone is a part of God's church. And when we go to the feast, we get to practice that. We get a little taste of that because it's, in a lot of cases, just us. It's predominantly us at the feast. Imagine all the problems that are going to disappear when it's just us throughout the whole world, when the entire world is a part of the church. You won't need to lock your doors at night. You probably won't even have a lock on your door. I don't recommend you try that when you go to the feast now. We're not out of the world yet. We still have others around us. But think of all the problems that will disappear when everyone in the world is learning God's way. It's good to be among like-minded people. Even if the only time you're among like-minded people is when you go to services. But it's a relaxing feeling that you get when you're there, when you're at the feast. You have this relaxing feeling. It's a feeling that you can't get at any other time of the year. And it's wonderful. It's a good feeling. It's a time when we really have a chance to set this world aside, to put everything that's going on in our lives behind us and forget about it for a little while. Can we look back at the feast that we've just kept and say, God was showing me something? That incident that happened on the fourth day, I think God was trying to show me something from what happened there. That thing that happened to me, I think God was telling me something. Maybe it was an interaction that you had with another person or another family. Maybe it was something that involved some of the local residents that you encountered. Or maybe some of the merchants you dealt with in the stores you were in. Or maybe it had to do with another church member. Since my very first feast, which was back in 1970, I've felt lessons being taught. Let me tell you something that happened to me in 1970. I went into a store in Mount Pocono. It was midway through the feast. And I went into this store. I don't remember what kind of store it was. It was a very small store. Maybe a small drug store or maybe it was a souvenir shop. I don't remember exactly. But I remember that while I was in the store, there was a girl that was brought up to the counter. She was maybe 10 or 12 years old. She wasn't very big. She had been accused of shoplifting. And she was brought up to the counter and brought up to the owner of the store, who started questioning her. And she said that her mother was in the store. And, of course, back in those days, When we went to Mount Pocono for the feast, we were the entire town. I mean, we just took over the town. And all the merchants in town knew that the church was there. And they knew that we were overwhelming the town. The merchant asked the girl's mother when she was brought forward to him, "Are you all a part of the church?" And I looked at the mother and I looked at the daughter and I said, "No way she's part of the church. She was shoplifting. How can she be a part of the church?" And the mother said, yes, I'm part of the church. And I thought, quit lying. You can't be a part of the church. Your daughter was shoplifting. What are you talking about? And so I was convinced in my mind that she was lying. And I remember even going back and telling one of the ministers there that somebody is spreading lies, and it's going to put it's going to bring a bad name to the church. And I advised him that somebody was out there doing that, and he said, okay, thank you very much. And that was pretty much the end of that conversation. And I left convinced that someone was trying to bring a bad name on the church. And then I turned the corner and I saw the girl and her mother at services. Turned out they were members after all. So I learned a lesson that day. I learned a lesson that, hey, we're not perfect either. And our children aren't perfect, and we still make mistakes, and we still do things that the rest of the world does too. And we have to overcome them, and we have to learn the right way. And there's a lot of us that, you know, we're not immune to these things. So that was what I learned back in 1970. Maybe you had some experience at the feast and you've not realized the lesson just yet. There may have been something there for you to learn and you haven't yet seen it. It hasn't yet sunk in. There are many ways that God uses the feast to teach us things. Now, the feast can bring out the best in people. It can make us just so totally happy and joyful, and we've just got this different emotion about us at the feast because we're so happy to be there. It can bring out the best in us. Unfortunately, it can also bring out the worst in us. Let me show you what I mean. It's very encouraging to see people going around helping and serving at the feast. People that are doing things to make everyone else have a good feast. It's really encouraging to see that. And it's good when we're able to help people and serve them in that way, to help them to have a better feast. Because that spirit of cooperation makes the whole feast run smoothly. When everybody's needs are met, when everybody has everything that it takes for them to have a good feast, that cooperation just makes everything work perfectly. A familiar scripture that I know you've probably memorized by now, but I'm going to read it anyway. You can turn to it if you want, but it's Psalms 133, verse 1. I know you know what it says. Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. And certainly it is good when we're all together like that and we're in that spirit of cooperation. What does it mean to dwell together in unity? Well, we come together for a common purpose. We all work together intending to achieve that purpose. That's why we're at the feast. We're looking to achieve that purpose. And if we all did this, if we all did everything we could to make the feast a wonderful experience for everyone, every feast would be perfect. There would be no problems. And we approach every feast, do we not, with the intent of making it our best feast ever? Isn't that something we've always said? This is going to be my best feast ever. And we go there intending that it will be. We might come home from the feast saying, yeah, it really was. Or we might come home and say, well, it wasn't as good as, you know, 1993. It wasn't as good as 2012. It wasn't as good as last year. But we go with the understanding that we're going to try to make it our best feast ever. And we understand that serving at the feast is important. And that our best feasts, the ones that we remember the most, the ones that we enjoy the most, are the ones where we got involved. The ones where we did some serving. When we let God use us, He works great things through us. His Spirit in us causes us to have a successful feast. But unfortunately, our carnal side sometimes makes an appearance. That carnal side just shows up. With many people in one place, we end up with what you would call people problems. Sometimes we're at the feast and we forget who we are. We forget why we're here at the feast. We forget what it's all about. We're the elect of God, and we need to live as such. We need to remember why we're here. But our humanity or our selfishness sometimes gets in the way. We have attitudes that pop up. Attitudes that appear that might not surface at home. We might have an attitude that shows up that the rest of the year it's not there. But at the feast, for somehow, the worst in us just comes out. How does that happen? In a different environment, our true self might come out. You know, we're in a different environment. We're in a different surrounding. And so we're going to react differently to certain things. And we might not even realize the problem until we get back home. Did you do anything at this feast that you wish you hadn't done? Did you do anything, or did you say anything, or did you act in a way that you wish you could take it back? Did you treat anyone badly? Did you say anything that you shouldn't have said, maybe to a member, maybe to a waitress in a restaurant, maybe to one of the local residents that you encountered? Did you do anything that you wish you could take it back? Did you just get upset with someone, or did you get impatient with someone? Was there something you did that you regret having done? God may be using this opportunity to show you something. You might be given that chance to see yourself in a different way, in a way that you wouldn't have acted at home. But at the feast you did, because you were in a different surrounding, and so you reacted a little differently. God may be using this opportunity to teach you something. The feast is a time to practice what we've already learned. What kind of Christian traits are sometimes tested at the feast? We have a lot of things testing us throughout the year, but we come to the feast and some other things are tested maybe more then than at other times. I'd like you to turn to the book of James, chapter 1. James chapter 1. James talks a lot about patience here. Patience is one of the things that we go to the feast and sometimes we're tested on. Now, maybe not so much today as back when we had 15,000 people in one site. But we still do get tested sometimes. Maybe it's traffic. Now, if you've been to Branson for the feast before, you've probably encountered heavy traffic. When all the shows are letting out, the roads get really congested. And sometimes it's difficult to move. It can test your patience a little bit. Maybe it's people. Maybe people test your patience. Maybe it's a line at a restaurant. You really wanted to go to this restaurant, and you get there and you find there's a 45-minute wait. Oh, I just don't know if I can wait. Test your patience sometimes. James chapter 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Patience is a good thing to have. I think we know that. I don't have to tell you that. But there are a lot of things that will try our patience, and sometimes they're silly little things. Sometimes they're things that don't matter. But we do have our patience tested at times. Are we tempted to speak out or complain about the problem? Drop down to verse 19. So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. We need to develop the attitude where we listen, but we don't react all of a sudden. We don't react spur of the moment. We don't speak out and we don't complain about things. You know, today we don't really have anything to complain about. In years past, as I said, when we had 15,000 people at one feast site, it really tested your patience. It took a half hour to get from one side of a hall to the other. And when the song leader got up and said, "We're starting services in 5 minutes and your seat is way over there," you're not going to make it. You're not going to get there in time. The first hymn will be over by the time you're seated. I remember in Lake of the Ozarks, in a parking lot that had only one exit, but it had parking enough for about, I guess there were 10,000 people there. And only one way out. I remember that long line. It took an hour or more to clear the parking lot after services. That'll test your patience. I took some videos of that parking lot when I was out there in 1980. There were long traffic jams in some of the sites that moved very, very slowly. And just think if everyone had a car. Not all the members had cars. But the ones who did really congested the roads. I remember Mount Pocono one year. It was 1970. Again, it was my first feast, and I had a friend stay over with me at the hotel one night. And we didn't have a car. Neither one of us had a car. We had to get to services the next morning. So we arranged for this fellow that was staying at our hotel to give us a ride. But he can only give us a ride halfway because he had to pick up a couple of widows and give them a ride in. So he can only take us as far as their hotel, and then we had to get out and find our own way from there. So he took us halfway and dropped us off. So we decided that we would hitchhike from there the rest of the way. Everybody here is in the church anyway, right? We get in there, there's this long line of traffic. Everybody's going to the festival building. And so they're all in the church, so we can hitchhike. It'll be safe, no problem. So we get out of this fellow's car and we walk down onto the highway. And my friend, he puts his thumb out. And immediately a car pulls over and picks us up. These church people are really nice, you know. They give us a ride if we need it. So we get in the car, we get in the back seat, and there was a young couple in the front seat, and they turned around and they looked at us and they said, "What's up with all this traffic?" Of all the cars in that long line, we had to pick the one who wasn't a church member. We explained what was going on, and they took us down into the center of Mount Pocono and dropped us off, and they went on their way. And then we caught a ride with some church members there the rest of the way, like the last half mile or so. But it was really a struggle to get to church with all of the traffic that we generated back in those days. So we have nothing to complain about today. Because, you see, back then, nobody complained. With all of the congestion, with all of the traffic, with all of the people, nobody ever complained. We had two services every day of the feast. And nobody ever complained that they just couldn't get where they needed to go in time. It's just the way it was. And I wonder if we'd be able to handle that today. Have we become so spoiled today that we wouldn't be able to do it? Would our attitudes be as calm and as positive as we all had back then? We always had somewhere we had to be. It was a very busy feast. We had every minute jam-packed with something. Today, would some of us get disgusted and just go home? Over the years, we've learned how to better organize. Did that kind of spoil us? Are we spoiled because things are better organized now and we don't have to worry about all these things that try our patience? I want you to turn to Jude 14. I want you to notice what happens here in Jude 14. Jude 14 says, "Now Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men also, saying, Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints." Now, I'm not trying to predict how many will be in the first resurrection. But I just want you to notice that it does tell us here that the number who will be coming with Jesus Christ when he returns, the number who will be accompanying him will be in the tens of thousands. Okay? Now that could be anywhere from 10,001 up to 99,999, or it could be more than that, we just don't know. Just a very big number. There are going to be a lot of people who are resurrected in the first resurrection. At least tens of thousands. Those tens of thousands of people. And remember, at the Poconos in the 70s, we only had 15,000, okay? So we're talking about maybe that number, maybe greater than that. Prior to the return of Christ, those who are resurrected are going to be taking part in what we call the wedding feast. The wedding feast is going to be attended by all of these tens of thousands of newly resurrected sons of God. At the wedding feast, are we all going to be identified by name? I don't know what the agenda is going to be. I don't know what the format of the wedding supper will be. We don't have any information regarding all that. We just know there's going to be a wedding feast. Will Jesus Christ greet each one of us individually? Is he going to come up to every one of us and give us a hug and say, "Welcome to the family"? If there are tens of thousands of us, that's going to take a little while. That's not going to happen in a half hour. It's going to take some time. I don't think any of us are going to be impatient. I don't think any of us are going to lose our patience just waiting for this to proceed and for the entire agenda to complete. But it's going to take a long time. I don't think anyone's going to be impatient then. It's not the way it's going to work. Patience is certainly a godly virtue. It's something we need to learn. Forgiveness is in some respects an extension of patience. You know, sometimes it takes a lot of patience to overlook a fault, to overlook something that someone has done to you. It takes a lot of patience to overlook things, especially if someone has done something to you over and over again and done you wrong in some way repeatedly. It really builds the patience in you. Proverbs 19:11. Proverbs chapter 19, verse 11. The discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, and his glory is to overlook a transgression. Being slow to anger certainly requires patience. The more people you have in a crowd, the more likely your toes are going to get stepped on. I know sometimes at the feast, even today, you know, even if we only have a few hundred in the hall, sometimes the aisles get a little crowded. Sometimes you might get your toes stepped on literally, if not figuratively. Did this happen to you at the feast, either literally or figuratively? Did you get your toes stepped on by someone? Did you have a problem? Did somebody do something that didn't sit right with you? If so, how did you handle it? How did you do when you got your toes stepped on? James chapter 5. James 5, verse 7. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. Are you compassionate and merciful? Do you overlook things when you're mistreated? Forgiveness requires having love for one another. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 7. It says here, but the end of all things is at hand. Therefore be serious and watchful in your prayers. And above all things, have fervent love for one another. For love will cover a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without grumbling. And we don't want to be grumbling and complaining and just fussing about things all the time. We shouldn't be allowing others to irritate us. You know, sometimes we'll get irritated just by the way a person looks at us. They might not do anything to us, just the look that we get might irritate us. We shouldn't allow that. We shouldn't allow ourselves to get into those attitudes. Colossians 3, verse 12. Says, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness and long-suffering, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has complained against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. Are we skilled at bearing with each other? You know, that requires overlooking some things. It requires that we overlook the things that irritate us. It means not reacting when that carnal side of us wants to. When our carnality wants to say, hey, I want to get upset about this. Forgiveness goes deeper than just our outward expression. You know, it's great if we can get past an offense or an irritation. It's great if we can be offended by someone and not say anything and just put up with it. But are we still silently condemning the person in our mind? In our minds, are we criticizing and maybe not saying it, but maybe thinking it? Let's say, for example, you went to a restaurant with somebody and you decided to split the bill with them. You know, they didn't give separate checks, so you decide that you and this other person are going to split the bill. And so the bill comes and it's maybe $40, so you each put in $20. And then you stop and you think, well, wait a minute now. I had a cheeseburger and he had a steak. He owes me, let's see, when you do the math, he really owes me about $3 because his bill was higher than mine. You know, you might not say anything, but do you let that in your mind? Do you let it build up in your mind and you think about that all the time? You decide that you're going to let it go, but your mind can't let it go. Because, after all, you got cheated out of $3. Next time you see that person, are you going to remember? Is that the first thing that's going to come to your mind? I remember I went to dinner with that person and I got cheated out of a few dollars. Now that's a simple example. And I don't think anybody's going to get upset over a couple dollars there, but you get the idea. Do you let things build up in your mind about somebody so that the next time you see them, that's the first thing you think about? See, that's not forgetting. That's not completely forgiving someone of something because you still have it in your mind. The spirit of forgiveness requires forgetting. And harboring thoughts about it is not real forgiveness. You're not really forgiving the person. It needs to be put out of your mind completely, and as long as it's in your mind, you have to deal with it. As long as it's in your mind, it's bothering you. Now, yeah, this person might have taken you for $3, maybe unintentionally, but maybe they made out better than you by a few dollars, but they're not thinking about it. They're not even aware of it because you didn't say anything, but because you're still thinking about it, it's bothering you. And you're the one that's suffering from it. They're not suffering from it. You're the one that's suffering from it. You know, it needs to be put out of your mind completely. And if you forget about it, you'll feel so much better about it. You won't feel any ill feelings. You won't feel any grudge at all if you forget about it. You're the one that you're hurting by that. You're the one that's suffering because you can't forget it. Did you come back from the feast with any ill feelings toward anyone? Whether it was expressed outwardly or just inwardly, doesn't matter. That's something that needs to be put behind us. Do you have anything against anybody? Did you have an experience at the feast where there was something that somebody did or something that someone did or said that didn't sit right with you and you just can't get it out of your mind? It's something that you need to forget. You need to put it behind you. You see how the feast is like a big lab experiment? We get this hands-on experience. All the things that we're taught in class, that is in Sabbath services all year long, all these things that we're taught, all these principles that we learn, we go to the feast and we get to experience it. We get to put it to practice. We get to try it out. Just like chemistry lab. You get to try it out. It helps you to understand the principles a lot better when you try it out. The next step after forgiveness is, of course, humility. Matthew chapter 20, verse 20. Matthew 20, verse 20 says, "Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. He said to her, 'What do you wish?' She said to him, 'Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one in your right hand and the other on your left, in your kingdom.'" The mother of these two disciples wanted her sons to have high positions in God's kingdom. The other 10 disciples were angry at them for asking. You know, what takes you asking for these high positions? They weren't upset because James and John were asking inappropriately. They weren't upset because it was not appropriate for them to request this. They were upset because maybe they pictured themselves in these top positions. Maybe they had hoped that they would be on the right and the left hand of Christ in His kingdom. And they thought that they would be somebody. They would be special in the kingdom. Christ explained to them what a ruler in His kingdom will be like. Verse 24. "When the 10 heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to Himself and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give His life a ransom for many." Being a ruler is a position of service. That's what Christ was trying to get across. To be a ruler is a servant's position. We don't go to the feast to be served. We go to the feast to serve. To help other people who are there at the feast. The feast gives us the opportunity to learn to be a servant. Gives us the opportunity to try it out. A hands-on experience. We have a good feast because of someone's service. When we go to the feast and we have a great time, it's because somebody made it that way for us. Somebody made it so that we could have a good feast. And when we go to the feast with the attitude of serving, our service makes the feast a good feast for somebody else. Having a good feast, you see, is a community effort. It's something that we all pull together to do. And we all work together to make the feast good for everyone. There's more to humility than having the attitude of a servant. We can actually serve to the point of being prideful. We can actually go to the feast and serve and then come back and say, boy, I did a good job. I really helped. I really served at this feast. In fact, they wouldn't have been able to do it without me. I did such a good job. I was a really profitable servant. You see, we can actually be proud of ourselves. We can serve to the point of being prideful. We can be high-minded about our good service. Nobody could have done as good a job as I did. You know, I really gave of myself, and it really worked out well. I did a terrific job. 1 Peter 5, verse 5. It's possible to be so humble that you're proud of being humble. Think about that one for a little while. First Peter 5, verse 5. Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that He may exalt you in due time. We don't want to be exalting ourselves. We don't want to be promoting ourselves. We don't want to be saying, I'm humble and I'm proud of it. You know, that's just not the way. We want to be careful that we don't build ourselves up and we think that we're being humble. We can't let ourselves get into any negative attitudes. Did anything happen at the feast that didn't sit right with you? Did somebody say something that offended you? Did you say something that might have offended someone else? People problems can arise because of differences. You see, no two people are the same. We all do things differently. Our way of doing things is not necessarily the only way. And if we think that it is, then we have a problem with humility. Maybe it's a simple thing like how somebody uses their festival tithe. You have a problem with someone who uses their festival tithe for something that you don't think is appropriate. Well, that's not right. That's not the way it should be done. And you get into an attitude about this person. You worry about you. There are little things that we might get upset about that don't mean a whole lot, but that bother us. Little tiny insignificant things. So why do I mention all this now, after the feast is over? Feast is behind us. These are issues that we might want to deal with before the feast. These are things that we might want to think about before we go to the feast. Why are we talking about it now? Because you see, the feast is like a lab exercise. It's like the opportunity to go and practice what we've been learning all year. To put to practice all the sermons that we had on humility and patience and faith and everything else, service, all the different things we hear sermons on all year long, we can put to practice at the feast. You know, after the lab work is done, if you're in a science class and you have a lab class, after the work is done, you analyze the results. You don't just do the lab work. After it's over, you have to analyze the results and come up with a conclusion. How well did I do? Is there anything I need to change? See, we need to analyze the conclusion of our feast, our lab exercise. How did we do when we were in a group of people? Did we live according to what we've been taught all year long? How did we do? Assess yourself. Think about it. Is there anything you would have done differently? When we go to the feast, we experience things from a different perspective, especially when it's a new feast site you've never been to before. You're experiencing it from a new perspective. And God might use that very thing to show us what we need to change. We see things from a different angle. They look different. And we can see ourselves differently from a different point of view. Patience and forgiveness and humility, they're just some of the lessons. There are a lot of lessons that we can learn. Was there anything that God was teaching you this year at the feast? Is there anything that He was trying to get through to you to show you that you needed to change? See, often we don't realize it right away. Often we don't notice it. And we might not get the picture until weeks or maybe months later. Think about it. What happened to you at the feast this year that maybe God was trying to teach you something? We've entered that stretch now between the feast and the Passover. Even longer this year because of the 13th month that's in the calendar this year. Having just returned from the feast, the experiences that we had are still fresh in our minds. Were you made aware of anything that needs attention? Were there any people problems that arose? Anything that indicates that you still need to do some work on yourself? Still things that you need to change and work on? Things that you want to work on between now and Passover? Do you need to work on patience? Do you need to work on forgiveness? Do you need to become more humble? It's not too early to start making a list. This Passover is, well, just a little over 6 months away. And we need to work on these things. And by Passover, we'll be examining ourselves again and evaluating where we are. Let's make a list now. Make a list of the things that God may have been trying to teach you. We can learn a lot from the sermons we hear at the feast. And certainly it's one of the most important reasons that we go, to hear the messages. But we also learn a lesson just from the experience of being there. So let's not overlook the lessons that God might be trying to show you. The feast is over, but the learning and the growing continues.